Previously on Beta.
And we absolutely cannot afford to relax the social distancing measures that we have in place.
By now you've heard about the 20-second rule. Wash your hands with soap and warm water for 20 seconds.
You can make your own mask at home. Yeah. All you have to do is put pieces together and you can sew your own mask if you want to.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up today on the show, author Sam Wasson gives us the lowdown on the great 1974 film Chinatown. The film, starring Jack Nicholson as iconoclastic PI Jake Gittes, reinvented film noir as we know it and featured an Academy Award-winning screenplay by Robert Towne.
Towne wanted Jake, his character, to be sort of a scoundrel. A guy who was really in business, who didn't really care, didn't really have a sense of personal values.
And singer-songwriter Eve Barsley on his storied musical career and the return of Clem Snide.
I really feel like I was called to do this, but the darker side of that is maybe I'm just doing it because I don't want to do it anything else, which is also true. So I wrestle with that, you know what I'm saying?
But first,
with all the work that you have done for those people, all the hours you put in, the effort.
It's not the company, Bess. They're not the ones that are forcing this.
They aren't. They picked seven Jews.
The entire government of the United States is leaning on them. The administration of a popular president is telling them to cooperate in a new program of national importance. You think a life insurance company can stand up to Charles A. Lindbergh? The big man in the little plane?
That's Zoe Kazan and Morgan Spector from the HBO miniseries, The Plot Against America. It's based on the 2004 novel by Philip Roth that envisions an alternative history in which Charles Lindbergh defeats Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1940 presidential election. David Simon is the man behind this reimagining of Roth's novel. David is best known for his work as writer, producer, and creator of the critically acclaimed, groundbreaking HBO series, The Wire. We caught up with David via Skype, so please excuse a few of the digital gremlins, as he told us what he thought of Roth's novel the first time he read it.
I thought it was interesting. Some people think he was writing to the allegory of George Bush, but I don't think so, and I think he denied it. I just thought it was an artifact of history. It was an interesting alternative view of what might have happened at a critical moment in American history. And it was pretty well researched. I mean, you know, Lindbergh really was the candidate that Roosevelt feared. And he feared it because of the simplistic message of anti-immigration, anti-xenophobia, isolationism, fascism isn't all that bad. That was scary. And that made Roosevelt vulnerable.
David, your adaptation focuses on the Levin family. Can you tell me a bit about the Levin family?
In the book, it was the Roth family, and Philip Roth used his own family as the narrative force to explain this dry run at American fascism. He imagined the events of his alternative world colliding with the lives of his parents, his older brother, and himself, as well as some extended family members, his young nephew Alvin, and his aunt. Evelyn, his wife's sister. And so you experience this totalitarian maneuver and this Lindbergh administration and all of what goes awry in America from the point of view of this one lower middle class family in Newark, New Jersey, in the Jewish section of Newark.
Alvin can't bear your Nazi-loving president. That's why he left. You know, not so long ago, you couldn't bear the man either. But now what? Stock market is up. Profits are up. Business is booming. Everything else about Lindbergh, what he stands for, is forgotten. What else matters to you, a businessman, if the money is right?
Boy, you know, you sound just like the stupid kid, what else matters? Do your boys matter? Sandy, you want him to come home one day like that? How about Philip? You want him to wind up in a grave in France or wherever the hell else? We are out of the war. We're staying out of the war. Lindbergh, he's done no harm to any of us, as far as I can see.
You know, that's the thing, Monty. You don't see much outside of your own little world.
Sounds improbable, but it's actually brilliant. And what it does is it makes us live as individuals through the notion and through the moment of us losing our republic. And what would we do? What would we stand up and say? What would we do? What risks would we take personally? And that's the ultimate question. I mean, that's, we've all played that game where we said, you know, what if slavery was going on? What would I have done in 1859? Would I have been John Brown, or would I have been hunting John Brown? If I was in Germany in 33, would I have stood up to the Nazi goons, or would I have acquiesced? We all like to think of ourselves as heroic, but we basically use the family to ask ourselves the same question.
Mm-hmm. How similar is the Levin family to the Simon family that you grew up in?
Culturally, they're the same. The dynamic in the family, my father did not have the fulminant anger of Herman Levin, but in the Simon family, we were brought up to argue politics, to argue with each other. Arguing was sport in my family. We enjoyed it very much. It was not a point of tension. It was, in fact, how you got attention.
I've read that the tagline for your series actually comes from your father, Bernie Simon. Can you tell me about that?
My father was the public relations director for B'nai B'rith, a Jewish service organization, for about 30 years. Before that, he worked for the Anti-Defamation League. He was basically a professional Jew. And, of course, I sat through many years, probably 45, 50 years, maybe more, of him leading the Passover Seder, the Passover celebration, the meal. And at a certain point in that ritual, he would always point out that democracy and freedom, these are things that are never completely won. That every day you have to go out and kill a few more snakes. Every day you have to assert for the rights that you have. That was a lesson he never failed to let what was effectively the Jewish holiday of freedom, Passover, go without making that argument. So, yeah, it came to me as we were trying to find something to put on the one sheet.
Yeah, freedom is never completely won, but it can be lost. Yeah. This is the first time you've adapted a work of fiction. Was that part of the appeal of creating this series?
It was a little mortifying because it was Philip Roth. This is a lion of American literature, a guy who at the end of his life was waiting around for the what seemed to a lot of people to be the inevitable Nobel Prize. The books that I had adapted, and quite faithfully, I think, were all works of nonfiction, so I couldn't take liberties. There was a real moment of mortification whenever we decided to change something or omit something, or it was tricky.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about the few changes that you did make and why you made them?
Sure. Some of them were at his request. I mean, the name changed to Levin was at his request. For me, you know, there were a couple of big changes, one of which was we had to go to points of view that were beyond a 10-year-old Philip who was remembering his childhood from adulthood, which is the structure of the book. That's just too much voiceover for any film to carry successfully. We had to expand the point of view to all the other members of it. And by doing that, I think we opened up the miniseries so that it could cover ground. Roth saw that right away and agreed to that was the way to go. And then I had another one. I don't want to ruin the end for people, but we did a little something with the end of the book and how the Lindbergh administration concludes. It happens a little fast in the novel and a little magically. And we needed a harder bit of plot. And so we worked hard on that. I was going to show those pages to him. I knew I had an argument on my hands, possibly, but he gave me permission to do it. And that I pointed out what I thought was the problem to him without saying what the problem is. And I sat there while Philip Roth, great man of literature, read those two pages over again. It felt like it was probably 4 or 5 minutes. It felt like it was 4 or 5 hours while I was sitting there. And finally, he closed the book and he looked at me and said, well, it's your problem now. And so I took that as permission.
Yeah, yeah. Philip Roth had a reputation for presenting one-dimensional female characters in his novels. And you've made a conscious effort to flesh out the women characters with the help of actors like Zoe Kazan and Winona Ryder. How did this approach help you tell the narrative?
Basically, I just come to characters and I just try to write them as well as I can. And those characters are in the book. And so part of it is just approaching the character and going, okay, it's time to write another point of view and make it credible. But part of it is the actors themselves.
They're after me. I know they are. I have to hide. You have to hide me. You stupid girl. Bess, I'm in danger. I'm afraid.
Don't you think that we're afraid too? Don't you think that we're in danger too?
We're all afraid. People are dead. Evelyn, people are dead. They're going to arrest me. They'll torture me, Bessie. Because I know the truth.
You know, they walk their humanity in front of the camera, and there's no arguing with that.
Mm-hmm. John Turturro plays Rabbi Lionel Bengelsdorf, and he becomes an important figure in President Lindbergh's administration, which leads to some friction in the Jewish community. What role does this character play in the story arc of your series?
He is the collaborator. He's the court Jew.
Our religion is independent of any piece of land other than this great country to which we commit our total devotion and allegiance as the proudest of citizens. I want Charles Lindbergh to be my president, not in spite of my being a Jew, but because I am a Jew, an American Jew.
We'll understand this dynamic because we've seen it in our own political moment, which is he's not there to convince Jews to vote for Lindbergh. The Jews are very, by and large, very aware of what Lindbergh stands for. What Bengelsdorf provides for him is a chance to be seen with a prominent Jew.
Does that idiot think one single Jew is going to go out and vote for this anti-Semite because of that stupid lying speech? And what does he think he's doing?
Koshering Lindbergh.
Koshering what?
Well, he didn't get him up there to talk to Jews. They didn't buy him off for that. Don't you understand? He's up there talking to the Goyim. He's given all the good Christian folks of this country their personal rabbi's permission to vote for Lindy and not to think themselves Nazis or anti-Semites. Can't you see what they just got the great Lionel Bengelsdorf to do?
There are ways in which people to be very comfortable with some very bad things by holding up one single example of a collaborator.
Mm-hmm. As a Canadian, I really like the storyline about the characters thinking about escaping to Canada. And even though I've been living here in the U.S. for 20 years, those scenes made me feel kind of homesick, which is unusual for me. Do you think that if you had been in Herman Levin's shoes, would you have made that move?
I don't know. Everyone thinks they would have. Everyone thinks they'd get out, that they'd see those, that they'd be able to smell what's coming for them, and they'd have the suitcase packed. I heard a fact along maybe 3 or 4 years that I'd never heard before about the Holocaust. One of the things that a lot of survivors cited when asked why they didn't get out in 35, 36, 37, as the Nuremberg laws came into effect, of all things, a lot of them had grand pianos. It sounds really trifling, but a grand piano was an expensive thing, particularly, you know, from some of the European makers, and all of the Jewish kids were either taking violin lessons and piano lessons, and they'd all invested heavily in this, and they just couldn't believe that Hitler was going to do the things he said he was going to do. They thought eventually everyone will come to their senses, and you know, while I can pack a bag and I can pack another bag and maybe I can ship this and ship that, the fact that the grand piano came up time and time again is something I'll never forget. Everyone thinks that they would maneuver quickly, but people get used to anything, sadly.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite scene or moment in The Plot Against America?
When you ask me that, I don't come up with the dramatic moments because those are carefully scripted, if not written by Roth originally, and mm-hmm. they play themselves in the sense of, you got to write them, you got to pace them, you got to shoot them right. But everybody knows their business. The things, when you ask me that, you come up with comedic moments because comedy is ineffable, and you can write a funny line, and then when you see it shot, it's just not where you thought it was going to go. And it's easy for different comic interpretations to send it in different directions. So when something works, when the actor gets the joke, when the actor delivers on the joke, when the comic timing is so hard. Right now, you ask that question, I'm thinking about Winona Ryder is in shul. She goes back to the synagogue, and she's there because she's now being wooed by the rabbi, by Bengelsdorf. And there's a place in one of the prayers, the Aleinu, where you're supposed to literally bow, bend the knee and bow. And all around her, she sees the people bow. First she goes down, and then of course they straighten, and she's still bowing, and then she looks up. And all the while she's trying to mouth the words as if she knows a single word to the prayer, and she does. I watched Winona do that. I think when the dailies came in, I watched them 5 times. I just kept laughing. I thought it was so human. It was so funny.
Lionel, I'm flattered, but the truth is I never even learned my Hebrew letters. I mean, we weren't particularly observant, especially after we lost our grandparents. Shouldn't you be looking to fill this position with somebody better versed in all of this? I mean, I can't tell you the difference between the Talmud and the
Mishnah.
Yeah, it's a great moment. Philip Roth died in 2018. What do you think he would think of your reimagining of his novel?
I will confess to something. When he passed away, the coward that is latent inside as a writer immediately said, well, at least I don't have to do that. After we finished filming it, after we were done, and I think we honored what was important in the novel in very, very key ways. And I think the expanded points of view and some of the stuff we did politically with Bengelsdorf and certainly what we did with Alvin at the end, I think it works. And now I would be curious to show it to him and get his reaction, you know, for better or for worse. I wish he was here in every sense.
Yeah. You've said that what you're trying to do is find a story that's worth telling. And this raises a question about the current state of television. Do you think TV has gotten any better at telling stories that are worth telling?
I think it's gotten bigger. I think there's just so many more stories being told. There are probably more stories that are meaningful and that are well executed and have a beginning, a middle, and end and can be seen in some almost literary way as being first-rate storytelling, yes, because there's more of it being done. There's probably much more in the same light. There's probably much more that's just dross. You used to have, you know, three networks full of dross. Now you have unlimited dross. I'm not sure the percentages are different or that much different, but I see an awful lot of shows that start with a great deal of promise. Universes begin to come together and are built, and premises are off, and then the show either runs out of steam or becomes popular, and that's death for storytelling. You know, stories have to have a beginning, middle, and end. One of the things I say in a writer's room when we get started on any project is we need to think about where we're going and why. And and in some respects, you write at least in your mind's eye, and sometimes in reality, you write the last page before you write the first page.
Interesting. David Simon, thank you very much. David Simon is the writer, producer, and creator of HBO's The Plot Against America, based on the Philip Roth novel of the same name. Find out more about David and the series at wpr.org/beta.
The thing I like about religion is religion gives you a way to turn your sorrow into grace. So I like to advocate for spirit, not so much for body. I think we get too much body, not enough spirit in the culture.
Musician Eef Barzelay joins us to talk about Clem Snide's album, Forever Just Beyond. That's coming up, Beyond the Break. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. I think it was Eef Barzelay who once coined the phrase, all life is suffering. That sounds about right, right? Anyway, the frontman for alt-country luminaries Clem Snide has had his share of suffering during his long-storied career. But Eef says he's always been able to get through it by writing songs. Clem Snide's latest record, Forever Just Beyond, navigates the mysteries of the human condition and features Eef's classic dark humor and newfound grace. He joined us to talk about the album and the wandering road of Clem Snide.
After high school, I moved to Boston. I tried Berklee College of Music for a couple semesters. Didn't take. So I dropped out of Berklee and I was just living in Boston and I was trying to get into some bands. So I got into this one band, and I sort of broke up the band, and I picked up the pieces, and that became Clem Snide in the early 90s. So yeah. It started in Boston, kind of more sort of a punk rock. It was very screamy, very shrieky. And then when we moved to New York, that's when I think I got more serious about writing songs.
Mm, yeah. The band's name is a reference to a William S. Burroughs character, and your songs often sound a little melancholy, and there's dark humor all over the place, which kind of has a Burroughsian or Burroughs-esque vibe. Was Burroughs a big influence?
I'm a little embarrassed by the name. I came up with that name when I was 20 years old, and I was trying hard to be some sort of beatnik. Mm-hmm. Yes. And yeah, so I just grabbed the name randomly. I didn't think much about it. At first, actually, it was just Snide. Not many people know that, but the first incarnation of the band, when it was more shrieky, was just called Snide. And then I added the Clem, I think, when it started getting more countrified.
Snide's a great name for a punk rock band, and then that doesn't betray any Burroughs influence. But I find it interesting that you say you were embarrassed, because, as you said, there are a lot of other bands, Steely Dan.
Soft Machine.
Soft Machine, yes, that's right.
I always secretly wish that we were called Soft Machine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's a nice name.
But is there a particular Clem Snide song that feels most Burroughsian to you?
I think the older stuff was trying more to be subversive or sarcastic. I think as I've gotten older, I've probably tried to move away from that kind of cheap nihilism. I think Burroughs, the thing I liked about Burroughs is just the freedom of it.
Yes.
I think in a way I live much more conservatively. I have a wife and two kids, but in my mind I like to just go wherever I choose.
Yeah. There was a pretty rapid rise for the band as you ripped through your first few albums in the late 90s and early 2000s. You had songs featured in film and on television, including your big hit Moment in the Sun, which was used as the theme song for the second season of NBC's comedy drama Ed. But the song was only used for that second season. Why?
Oh, I don't, you know, that's a strange and complicated story as to how that song ended up being used for second season of Ed, because I found this out later on that it was largely to do with 9/11. 9/11 had interrupted their business such that they were so desperate that they ended up having to use it, but they never really got behind it, and I think that the fans were not so in love with it. Most people preferred the other one.
When it's my moment in the sun, oh, how beautiful I'll be.
Yeah, somebody said, one of the fans of Ed said it sounded like someone torturing a yak, which I don't think is right at all. I think it's a beautiful song, and it really captures the vibe of Ed.
I think it sounds more like someone gently caressing a yak.
Yes, exactly.
My voice is the sound of a happy yak. I think the irony, it's a delicious irony that song is all about a very fleeting moment in the sun. It was aware of itself in a crazy sort of way.
To say, and you'd be wise to listen good.
Clem Snide's Wikipedia page refers to an ill-fated post 9/11 tour. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, right. So that record, The Ghost of Fashion, came out spring of 2001. So September 8th, 2001, we kicked off our big cross-country tour. Mm-hmm. Oh, all right, let me tell you, I'll tell you the best story about touring during 9/11. This is a true story. So we're in San Antonio, Texas, like September 14th, you know, just days after. And we're driving a big 15-passenger van with New York plates, maroon. And we're lost in San Antonio, and we're taking all kinds of weird turns. And all of a sudden, there's one cop behind us, and then two, and then three, and they're yelling at us, and one of them comes up to the window, and they pull us out of the van, and they're like, get down on the ground. They make us lay down on the ground, and they start reaching into our pockets and pull out my wallet, and they're just like rifling through my wallet. It's okay, we're musicians, you know. And they thought that there was an APB out, that there were some terrorists about in a maroon 15-passenger van with New York plates. And then we kept getting stopped. We got stopped two more times. One time we got stopped in the middle of nowhere. We were driving through the desert in West Texas, and we get pulled over, and the cop shines this flashlight in the van, and he goes, oh, you're that band. All right, never mind. So there were only two bands in Texas then, the terrorists and Clem Snide.
my moment in the sun. I won't forget that I am blessed.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a great story. So when did things start to fall apart for Clem Snide? Maybe with all these APB stops, or
that was the beginning.
Yeah. So what happened?
Well, you know, it was hard to keep it all together because when you're doing it at that level, you start to get some success and a little bit of money starts coming in, and then it sort of morphs into more of a business. And all the while, one guy, Jason, got his girlfriend pregnant, and then they had to move to France. Huh. People were always dropping out, the drummer, Eric. Well, you know, it's kind of a slow motion accident, as the song says.
Right.
But yeah, by 2010, I was the last man standing. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. There was a time when fans could hire you to write original songs for them. Our producer, Brad, hired you to write a song for his wife, Jenny, to celebrate their 10th wedding anniversary.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Did writing these songs for people change the way you approached writing songs for yourself?
Yeah, I'd say it really has helped me. You know, it really has, because in a way, when you're writing a song for someone else, you can really kind of take your own ego out of it completely and put yourself into this other person's perspective. So you would think, it's almost counterintuitive. You would think, you know, there's only so much songwriting, you know, juice inside, and I'm using it for these personal songs. But I found that the more songs I wrote for people, the more songs I wrote just in general, you know, it opened up that portal ever wider.
Oh, Jenny, my sweet wife, go run with a kid. And then tumble in sweet peals of laughter.
You've got this new album out, this new Clem Snide album, Forever Just Beyond. And you've said about this album, you've said that the last 10 years have been a roller coaster of despair and amazing opportunities that somehow present themselves at the last possible second. Can you tell me about this decade of despair that you've experienced?
My decade of despair. Right. So like I was saying before, right around 2010, 2011, things really bottomed out for me. And apart from the band falling apart, and I had a bitter breakup with a former manager, and that cost me a bunch of money. And so here we are, me and my wife, two small kids, and we went into foreclosure. And so I had to declare bankruptcy.
I'm sorry.
See, my thing is, I can't do anything else. I really feel like I was called to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But the darker side of that is maybe I'm just doing it because I don't want to do anything else, which is also true. So I wrestle with that. You know what I'm saying? Like, am I being true as an artist, or am I just being self-indulgent? Anyway, but then I've always worked through that process by writing songs. Like, no matter what I'm going through, I always write my way through it. But then crazy stuff would fall down into my lap and save me financially. In 2015, don't even ask me how I ended up with this gig, but I wrote a little turnaround for Chobani Greek Yogurt, and for about 4 to 6 months, I was the voice of Chobani Greek Yogurt.
It's the only 100-calorie light Greek yogurt with zero preservatives. To love this life is to live it naturally.
And I was even in the commercials. They put me in the commercials. I wore a hat, a little vest. I was the minstrel, the wandering minstrel. Yeah. And that saved me financially and my family. So it's like surfing, you know, just try and stay on the board.
Yeah.
You know, wait for your wave and then hope you don't get knocked off the board.
Yeah.
That's the best analogy I can think
exactly.
of.
Exactly. It's a good analogy. And so this new Clem Snide album is called Forever Just Beyond. It's produced by folk rock heavy hitter Scott Aivett of the Aivett Brothers. How did you meet Scott?
Yeah, actually, someone, a dear and old fan, Mark, you know who you are, Mark, sent me a link of Scott Aivett playing a rather obscure Clem Snide song as an encore at one of their big shows.
I did not write this song.
You're singing it well.
It's a Clem Snide song, if y'all want to go check it out.
And so, yeah, I reached out to him. At first, more through management, you know, but he got back to me quick. And then, yeah, I just kept sending him songs. I just was trying to entice him to work together and to maybe make a record. And he agreed. You know, what an angel.
Did you know these were Roger Ebert's dying words?
The opening track in the first single is called Roger Ebert. What inspired this song?
Yeah. I've always been very interested in near-death experiences. And I think I was going down some rabbit hole along those lines, and I stumbled upon an interview with Chaz, Roger's wife, after he died. And she just talked about the experience that he was having in those last few moments. And he really did seem to starting to kind of see behind the curtain, you know, and he was writing her notes that said it's all an elaborate hoax.
He wrote in a note that he passed to his wife as he felt himself shedding the skin of this life. It said, there is a vastness that can't be contained or described as a thought in the flesh of our brain. It's everything, everywhere, future and past, dissolving together in eternal flash.
And that feels right to me. You know, I'm not a religious person. I was raised by godless Jews, but the thing I like about religion is religion gives you a way to turn your sorrow into grace. Mm. So I like to advocate for spirit, not so much for body, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
I think we get too much body, not enough spirit in the culture, you know?
Yeah. Have you thought about releasing Roger Ebert as a vinyl 45 with a song called Gene Siskel on the B-side?
Yeah, no one. Gene Siskel went straight to hell. Yeah. No one. Yeah. He was the evil one, right? Yeah, Roger was like the good one, and Siskel was more the negative Nancy.
Yeah.
No, I didn't mean that. I take that back.
Okay.
It's all an elaborate hoax. It's all an elaborate hoax.
Your signature sense of dark, dry humor really shows up on a song like Easy, which features the line, "It's easy to say you would never sell out when no one has made you an offer." Are you open to offers these days to sell out?
Yeah, that kind of goes with what I was saying just before, I guess, that we all have these false ideas about ourselves. We all think we're good, we all think we're brave, and we all think we're right. And in a way, you never really know yourself unless you're tested. So you know what I'm saying? Like, the point of life, in a way, is to suffer, I think. It's to turn your suffering into grace.
Yeah, that's the Buddhist view, isn't it? Life is suffering, yeah.
Yeah, you don't really know who you are until you've really been tested by life.
Say you would never sell out when no one has made you an offer.
So was creating these songs on Forever Just Beyond, was it therapeutic for you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's always writing a good song, it's always the most therapeutic thing there is for me.
Yeah. And do you hope that these songs are therapeutic for listeners?
That would be the most wonderful thing, absolutely.
Mm.
I mean, it has to connect with other people. It doesn't, that's another thing too about it, I realized, is it's like if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, like it actually doesn't make a sound.
Right.
I can solve that ancient riddle. It doesn't. Believe me, I know firsthand. If there's no one there, they hear it. So this is true with songs. They live inside of other people's brains and hearts and souls, whatever, you know.
Eve Barzilay is the man behind the latest Clem Snide album, Forever Just Beyond. Find out more about Eve and Clem Snide at wpr.org/beta.
That's the way Hollywood used to work. You bet on talent, even if you didn't understand the screenplay. You would say, I'm going with this guy because this guy is Robert Towne, and his talent is the best way to ensure a successful picture.
Sam Wasson on how the movie Chinatown marked the end of an era in Hollywood. Sam joins us to talk about this landmark film in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Ch- Chinatown is one of the most iconic films from the 1970s. Roman Polanski directed it, Robert Towne wrote the Oscar-winning screenplay, and Jack Nicholson starred as a different kind of detective. It also signaled the end of an era in Tinseltown. That's the argument that Sam Wasson makes in his book, The Big Goodbye, Chinatown and the Last Years of Hollywood. Sam joins us and shares the reason he wanted to devote an entire book to Chinatown.
Well, the obvious answer, the most accessible answer, is I love the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But why I decided to write about it now was because when Trump won, I turned to my friend Graham, who I was watching the election with, and I, after a moment of just like abject shock and speechlessness, I thought to myself, what's the movie precedent for this? You know, I'm a movie guy, so I think, you know, I look for stories in movies, I guess, the way other people look to, you know, religion. How can I organize my thinking around this kind of terror and corruption? And the first character that came to my mind was Noah Cross from Chinatown.
See, Mr. Gitz, either you bring the water to L.A. or you bring L.A. to the water.
How are you going to do that?
By incorporating the valley into the city. Simple as that.
How much are you worth?
I have no idea. How much do you want?
I just want to know what you're worth. Over 10 million?
Oh, my, yes.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gitz. The future.
So then I thought, oh, okay, yes, that's what's going on now. And in the course of research, I began to get more into the metaphor of Chinatown and saw that it was really about trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Because Nicholson's character has a Chinatown in his past. Something bad happened in Chinatown in his past, and it turns out that he repeats it. And I thought, oh, well, this is about all of us. I mean, Trump or not, we are all, whether we know it or not, compulsively repeating the traumas of our past. So the human condition component of it was profound.
Mm, yeah. In 1969, Robert Towne tells his girlfriend, Julie Payne, that he wants to write a movie for his friend Jack Nicholson. What kind of a story did Towne have in mind when he first started thinking about Chinatown?
He wanted to write something about the Los Angeles that he remembered that was gone. He grew up in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And the impetus for his nostalgia was the Manson murders, the Tate LaBianca murders, which changed the city literally overnight. A lot of people use, you know, overnight to mean, well, maybe a couple weeks.
But this is literally overnight.
This is, yeah. It was literally overnight. And so one could look back to even yesterday and say, LA was different yesterday. And that became the basis for Towne wanting to investigate other changes in L.A. and the origin story of L.A. And Julie Payne went to the library to do some research, and she brought back a book by Carrie McWilliams called Southern California, An Island on the Land, which is a beautiful book, not just a great history, but beautifully written.
Mm.
Anyhow, in that book, Towne found the story of what became the basis of Chinatown.
Yeah, that's the story about the true life story about the Owens Valley water wars, correct?
Yes, the stealing of the water, the forcing of a drought, the buying up the land. And he realized, wow, Los Angeles is built on a crime. And not only that, but the criminals get away with it. And not only that, but they're celebrated because they're looked back upon as the city fathers.
Yeah.
So the ironies of that were terrible and compounded by what was going on at Vietnam and Watergate and Nixon. Our leaders were showing themselves to be bad guys, Noah Crosses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you take me back to the day, whenever it was, when Robert Towne proposed this idea to Jack Nicholson?
Well, Towne and Nicholson had been buddies going back to the 50s. They had gone to acting school together, Jeff Corey's acting class. So by the time Towne sits down to write Chinatown, they've known each other for, maybe 15 years. Towne hasn't had a breakout. He's had some small success. And Nicholson is, although a movie star, not a leading man. So Towne says to Jack, I am going to write you a part that will make you a leading man with a love story. that happened on Quincy Jones's tennis court.
Hmm.
And Jack said, oh, you know, whatever you want, Beaner, which is what he called Town.
Robert Town wanted Jack to play a different kind of detective in this film, different from what we'd seen in film noir and previous detective movies. Can you talk a bit about that?
If you look at the tradition of Chandler, the most famous writer of detective fiction, certainly one of the most famous writers of L.A. fiction,
mm-hmm.
his guy, Marlowe, had a real morality. He was noble. In fact, Chandler even thought of him as a sort of a modern-day knight, an urban knight.
Hmm.
Town wanted Jake, his character, to be sort of a scoundrel, a guy who was really in business, who didn't really care, didn't really have a sense of personal values. You know, in a way Town put it was he would do divorce work, which is dirty business.
Yeah, listen, pal, I make an honest living. People only come to me when they're in a desperate situation. I help them out. I don't kick families out of their houses like you bums down at the bank do.
Jake, can I tell you about the guy who
maybe like to step down out of the barber chair? Maybe we go outside and discuss it. What do you think?
Marlowe would never do divorce work.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So that gave the Gittes character something of an arc. It gave him a way to go. He would start as this sort of venal louse and turn into a guy who really has to learn to stand up for something.
Mm. Do you think that's what interested Town about portraying Gittes as a scoundrel in order to have that character arc?
Well, I think there's a lot of Town in that. There's a lot of every screenwriter mm-hmm. in that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of any Hollywood person in that. Those of us in Hollywood have to deal with this question of, are we doing divorce work metaphorically? I mean, are we doing good work?
Yes.
Or are we just earning a buck? Yes. So it was a story that was close to Town, close to, you know, everyone that Town worked with, everyone in Hollywood, really.
Mm-hmm. So how does the legendary studio executive and film producer Robert Evans become involved in the making of Chinatown?
Well, Town doesn't want to sell Evans the screenplay for the longest time because Town wants to direct it. And as soon as he sells it to Evans, then it belongs to Evans, and Evans can decide, you know, what he wants to do with it. He can have anyone direct it. But Town spent so long writing this that he ran out of money and so was forced to sell it to Evans, and in so doing, lost the ability to direct it himself. And that's how Evans got involved. But what's so significant about how Evans got involved, and this is part of what the book is about, is that Evans didn't understand the movie, but he said yes anyway, because for him, all that mattered was talent. And he had faith in Robert Town's talent and mm-hmm. faith in Jack Nicholson's talent. And the significance to that is that that's the way Hollywood used to work. You bet on talent. Even if you didn't understand the screenplay, you would say, I'm going with this guy because this guy is Robert Town and his talent is the best way to ensure a successful picture. Now we bet on IP, or what's called intellectual property. We bet on Harry Potter. We bet on Star Wars. The talent of the screenwriter almost is an afterthought, but the brand is what studios are buying. So Evans was really heroic in taking that giant risk.
Yeah. You were able to interview Robert Evans for your book. He passed in October 2019. But what did you learn about the production of Chinatown from Evans?
Well, I learned basically that he, for the most part, kept his hands off. You know, Evans, he famously with Coppola inserted himself where he should not have and caused a lot of difficulty. He was a producer and a sort of closeted artist who had a vision of himself as a shaper of films. And he could get a little too handsy at times with the movie, but for the most part, he put his money on the artists and let them do the work. He would say, you know, I'm buying Roman Polanski. If I want to get my money's worth, I'm going to let Roman Polanski be the genius that he is.
Yeah. So how did Roman Polanski end up directing Chinatown?
Nicholson and Roman had always talked about doing something together.
Hmm.
And Roman was a huge fan of Raymond Chandler, whom he had read in Polish as a boy. And Roman, of course, you know, he actually needed the money. He wanted to work. What he didn't want to do was come back to L.A. after the Tate murders. He had been living in Rome quite happily.
Yeah.
And was finally successfully persuaded to come back to America to make this movie because he wanted to work with this group of his friends, including Evans, with whom he had made Rosemary's Baby, and the great production designer Dick Stilbert, and the great editor Sam Osteen. So they said, Roman, come back. We'll take care of you. It won't be scary. And in fact, it wasn't scary. It was a very happy, smooth production.
Chinatown has one of the most shocking twist endings in the history of American film. Can you talk a bit about that and how important do you think it is to the film?
I do think it's important, obviously. I mean, because it talks about how corruption is not just political. It is personal. And a man like Noah Cross will corrupt anything. It really drives the story home for those people who, up until that point, have been watching a movie about California water rights.
Mm-hmm.
It says, actually, this movie is about all of us. It is about the dangers of power down to the domestic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone saw that coming.
She's mine, too.
She's never going to know that.
Evelyn, you're a disturbed woman. You cannot hope to provide.
Evelyn, put that gun away. Let the police handle this.
He owns the police.
What is Chinatown's legacy?
It's the American nightmare. It's, as Robert Towne said, it represents the futility of good intentions. Mm. And that is the opposite of the American dream, where good intentions will get you everywhere. Chinatown says good intentions, not only will they get you nowhere, but sometimes they will make things worse off than they were before.
Most people think that Robert Towne's screenplay was what made Chinatown such a great film. After all, he did win an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for it. But you give more of the credits Roman Polanski. Why?
Well, A, what he did to the screenplay, and B, the filmmaking. The sense of doom that you get from watching the movie. The sense of emotional urgency, which was not so much in Towne's early version of the script. The nuance of the performances and the production design, you know, this team that Roman assembled. Obviously, none of it exists without Robert Towne's script, so I don't want to diminish Towne's contribution. But this haunted quality is not really something that we think of as Hollywood. It would take a European to come to Los Angeles to make a movie that feels as doomed as Polanski's movie and as doomed as Chinatown.
Mm. Actors recently walked out in protest after Roman Polanski won Best Director for his film J'accuse at the French version of the Oscars because of his history of sexual assault accusations. Mm-hmm. Do you mm-hmm. think that's something we have to consider and reckon with when we think about Chinatown?
I think, in fact, Roman Polanski's made an incredible contribution to the world through his work. He also did this horrible thing. So I'm at a loss to understand why either one would cancel the other one out.
It would seem
to me that both are facts. I'm grateful that he continues to make movies because if he wasn't allowed to make movies, we wouldn't have The Pianist, which has got to be one of the greatest Holocaust movies ever made, arguably the greatest. So I'm confused why one would have to pick one over the other.
Mm. At the end of your book, you talk about how Chinatown was one of the last movies made in the filmmaker-friendly studios, which were at that time being replaced by the corporate Hollywood of today. What do you think we've lost because of this change?
An art form. I mean, we can still make movies. Good movies will always be made. As long as there is an iPhone and a talented filmmaker, we will always have movies. We will not always have Hollywood movies, movies made by the studio. And that is a certain kind of filmmaking, a certain level of craft, expertise, productivity that only a studio with the resources to pay for productions of this kind can maintain. So that kind of movie, I'm sorry to say, is dying, if not dead.
Mm. But to riff off of another great movie, we'll always have Chinatown.
Yes, we will. Thankfully, we will. And hopefully people will look at Chinatown and they will say, oh, that's not television.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Neither is it what we're seeing in the movie today. That is a way of making film that we call Hollywood. It is a language that is no longer spoken. And so I, as someone who loves that language, want to stand up and say, I wish it were still here.
Sam Wasson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
Sam Wasson is the author of The Big Goodbye, Chinatown, and the Last Years of Hollywood. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, David Simon, Eve Barzilay, and Sam Wasson. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
And you get so much publicity, you gotta get blasé about it. You're practically a movie star.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Would you call him a capable man?
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I'm just trying to make a living. I don't want to become a local joke.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
I think you know all you need know about me.